Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Wealth. I'm Alex Teager. I'm joined today by Ian Wenick and, as a special treat, Andrew Forsch. Andrew, good to have you not only on the pod, but in person on the pod.
Yeah, it's good to be here. I've missed being here in the studio with you fellas. I wasn't sure I was going to make it. I was down with the sickness, but the immune system held it down, and here we are. We made it.
Yeah, you've been very ill. I don't know if the listeners want the details, but it's not been good. But you're much better now. That's the main thing.
Let's just say daycares are gross places. Not gross, but you know.
So what's the word? Petri dishes.
Yeah, that's it.
Do you say petri or petri in America?
Petri.
Petri dishes for...
Yeah, these kids got germs.
Yeah, for some pox that laid you out.
That's right.
Well, we're glad you're better, and we're very glad that you're here. And I guess we're going to start with some misdirection, because you're here because Citywire USA, this week, is having, or will have just had when this goes out, its 10th anniversary party, or 10th birthday party. I'm not quite sure what the right way of saying it is, which is very exciting. I say it's misdirection, though, because we're not going to talk about Citywire being 10 this episode. We might next week do a kind of look back and some serious navel gazing, but this week we're all focused on the current, not the past, because it's been a massive week for Ian Wenick deals. And if there's one man who loves a deal in this room, it's you, really. And we've had two huge ones, so maybe tee up both of them and then we'll go into some detail.
Yeah, you know, I think I teased a couple weeks ago that this was going to be a busy summer. You know how Seinfeld, we had the Summer of George? This is the Summer of Scoops.
The Summer of Scoops. That's a big, big bold claim. It's a big bold claim to make in early June. That's what I was saying.
Oh, well, that's true. It's technically spring. It's the Spring of Scoops.
Yeah. But I meant more, you know, now you've got to back it up. It's something that I might claim in like mid to late August, you know, when things are in the books. Okay, well, let's start. There's two big stories we're going to talk about then. So it's Hightower, which is pursuing a sale, and then Summit Trail, another large RIA, different type of firm, which we'll come on to, also pursuing a sale. So both these firms have hired investment banks and are looking for investors. Let's start with Hightower. So as we sort of joked before in the word cloud of this week in wealth, you know, it may not be LPL or Schwab, but Hightower is definitely a large and visible word in terms of what we've spoken about over the last 70 odd episodes. And this ties into all of that. This ties into its journey. It's sort of everything. So yeah, what's the story first? Then we'll jump into the background.
So the story is that Hightower, which again, I'll give the extreme cliff notes, about $354 billion in assets, hundreds of advisors. They have hired Goldman Sachs and Ardea Partners, also a big figure in the word cloud, as they pursue a sale of a controlling stake in the company. For context, Hightower has been backed in some capacity by private equity firm Thomas H. Lee Partners.
Since 2017.
Yes, that's when THL first invested. Heretofore referred to as THL. And THL has extended its time horizon its investment in Hightower, but it's obvious that they need some sort of monetization event soon, while probably keeping at least a portion of their stake just to keep maintaining. They're going to get a great return on this if they get something done, basically.
Okay. And very quickly, because I was conscious we spoke a lot about DFA last week, and we didn't add this, I suppose, caveat in. I don't know if it's necessary, but as with that story, as with these stories, this is our reporting. This is based on deep, trustworthy sources. I'm not for a moment saying it's not accurate, but we should just, I suppose, be clear for the interest. This is based on our reporting. This is not official party lines from either of these firms.
Yes, that's correct.
If you read it on citywire.com/RAA, I think you know we're not going to publish lightly. We very much, as far as we're concerned, it's true. Okay, so Thomas H. Lee's been in there since 2017, looking to do so, which obviously quite a long time.
Yes.
You've done this before, Ian, on the podcast, but give us the 1 minute here on Hightower and where this kind of fits in with its various sort of business cycles that it's been through.
Okay, super fast. You can get the timer up if you want.
Well, I did last time, and then you made me put too much time on it. And then by the time went off, the tension had left.
Okay, How about you just count up instead of counting down, and then we'll set an over-under of 95 seconds.
No. One.
Oddly specific.
None of this should stay in the podcast. We're doing 1 minute on the clock, listener. It's starting now.
All right. Hightower, founded in Chicago 2007 by Elliott Weissbluth, originally a haven for ex-wirehouse advisors. The original plan was to IPO, but Hightower was not able to get that done. It lost many advisory teams because their equity options vested. Thomas H. Lee Partner comes in, infuses $100 million. New CEO comes in, Bob Oros. Hightower pivots to a new strategy focused on M&A. 2020, THL brings in Goldman, Collar Capital, Neuberger Berman through a single asset secondary sale, extends his time horizon. 2023, they try to sell the business, hire Raymond James, can't get it done. Bob Oros steps aside in 2025. Larry Restieri comes in, ex-head of Goldman's ACO, and Larry has led a new consolidation strategy, and the plan is to hopefully get an investor in now.
Okay, well, you've got 15 seconds left. Anything else you want to say?
Yeah, so Hightower's also adopted a new consumer-facing brand known as Hightower Signature Wealth, which is using for internal consolidation.
Okay.
On a regional basis.
We've got 5 seconds of air to fill before this timer goes off. I'm just going to let it run down. Listen to this, listener. There you go. So very impressive, Ian. You did it in a minute. This is Restieri. This is what he's done. So I guess this is the second big thing he's done. The first being the creation of Hightower Signature Wealth, which, as discussed at least twice on the podcast, is bringing together a bunch of firms, effectively sort of internal consolidation, yes, succession vehicle, getting assets all in one place, yes, giving it a consumer-facing brand, and also having the benefit of kind of tidying a few things up internally and potentially, obviously by centralizing things, potentially making things a bit more valuable for a possible sale. Do we have any idea in terms of what they're looking for here? Is it a total sale, a partial sale, to a strategic? Do we have any sort of read on any of that?
I was just told a controlling stake. So I think for context, the Hightower that tried to recap in 2020 and tried to recap in 2023 was much more of a loser confederation of assets and independent practices than the Hightower that we see now. Is Hightower all the way there in terms of what it's trying to do from a consolidatory perspective? No, but it's rolled out this centralized investment platform. It has Hightower Signature Wealth. It's pursued external acquisitions to Hightower Signature Wealth. So is Hightower going to go the full focus and try to consolidate everything into 2 or 3 hubs? Not necessarily, but there's this clear push of trying to drive efficiencies, drive scale. And if you find those efficiencies,
be a bit more uniform, be, yes, a bit more centralized. Yeah.
And if you can find those efficiencies, then it makes it more likely that you can find either a private equity sponsor or a strategic or some sort of other investor that's willing to kind of check the valuation they want because the margin's there, because the efficiencies are there.
Got it. And in terms of the current ownership, so Thomas H. Lee has, well, you ran through some of it. Thomas H. Lee still has the controlling stake or the majority of the company?
Yes, I believe that's true.
Okay, plus there's other outside investors that you discussed that, yes, bought in the secondaries, plus previous investors, employees,
yeah,
advisors, executives, yeah, etc.
And it's worth noting that when THL came in, now this is kind of, you know, this is almost a decade in the past, but some of the original advisors or early stage employees had their equity kind of crammed down when THL came in.
Okay, got it. All right. So people could stand to do pretty well out of this if indeed it happens. Obviously, the caveat there being, it hasn't happened before, but to your point, it's a different business,
yes,
today and a different market today. Like, it seems like, to your point of this being sort of a summer of scoops, this is a year of a lot of M&A, not just, yes, in the wealth management space, but also in the wealth management space.
Yeah. And this is going to be an interesting bellwether because I think back to when Edelman tried to find a deal with a strategic partner and it failed in large part because Edelman did not have the organic growth rate that these outside investors were looking for. We've talked about before this idea of like the law of large numbers, that it's hard to grow organically when you get to certain asset figures, get to certain levels of scale. And so I'm curious. I wish that I was in the data rooms looking at Hightower's organic growth numbers because that's going to be just positive as to whether they're going to get a deal done or not, probably.
Okay, really interesting. I guess we should say, obviously, Hightower and Edelman, relatively different business models.
Yes, very different business. You know, but again, Hightower did make a big acquisition, an 80% stake in a large investment consultancy, which is somewhat analogous to Edelman's historic 401k plan business.
Okay, the idea of having sort of a lower margin.
Yes.
But big book of business that could potentially throw off,
yes,
referrals,
exactly,
et cetera.
Okay.
Other major, mega RAs have done that too. Who else am I thinking of? I think Marty Mariner bought a big business,
yes,
like that, an investment consultancy, Cardinal.
Crescent, yep, as well.
Crescent bought a big one.
Peter Malukin Creative bought SageView, and they bought the 401k business from Lockton. So there's a precedent there.
Okay. And what do you think, Ian? You asked me this last week about DFA, and I found it quite difficult to answer, but I'm nothing if not hypocritical, so let me throw it back at you. Who who could buy Hightower?
Yeah, so I mean, there are some large private equity firms that if I wanted to make a massive splash, could cut a check. You know, there's the CVCs of the world that don't have a big headline platform RA investment. What I think would be more likely, again, this is just informed speculation, this isn't sourced, this is just kind of thinking out loud. You know, this is a business where maybe a sovereign comes in, kind of like what happened with Mubadala Capital and Corient. Or you see a club deal where we have a mixture of sponsors and sovereigns. But I know, again, I think it's very difficult for, you know, there's only so many buyers on a strategic perspective that can cut a check large enough to take down one of these businesses. And it's even tougher to find one of them that can cut that, take the whole business down and provide a culture that the advisors want to stay for.
Absolutely. Well, as I think we say far too often, we will watch this space. Now, related, Andrew, or somewhat unrelated, we had another story on Hightower in the last week, which is much less big strategic sort of corporate cycle stuff and much more day-to-day business of being effectively a sort of an advisor consolidator or, you know, large serial acquirer of RIAs. So this was your story that they're suing an Alabama 3 who tried to solicit some clients.
That's the allegation, at least. Yeah, there was a group of advisors with a Hightower, formerly with a Hightower affiliate called Twickenham Advisors in Huntsville, who have left to join Fifth Third Bank's wealth management channel, their private client channel. And they've opened up an office. And yeah, I mean, look, this is fairly par for the course with large private equity-backed acquirers who have, you know, either invested in teams of advisors or acquired them outright. Their perspective is, you know, we've paid for these clients, we've paid for this book, and you can't just leave and solicit those clients to join you at your new venture. You've got to kind of start from scratch if we've paid you for those relationships. Now, the advisors, of course, are arguing, well, we haven't actually done anything wrong. We haven't actively solicited these clients. Maybe we've accepted that business
came to us.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And of course you can't, you know, restrict an investor from working with their advisor of choice. But you can restrict the advisor's behavior, the way that they communicate with those people once their employment ends. So the facts are up for disputes, in the court system. Now we'll see what ends up happening. But, again, this is sort of par for the course for firms like Hightower. Hightower has sued outgoing, you know, departing advisors before in recent years, but the timing is interesting just given, obviously, Hightower is going to be incentivized right now as they go to market to make any push that they can to keep as much assets on the platform as possible. Now, with this particular team, we're talking about, you know, maybe tens or maybe hundreds of millions of dollars. We're not talking billions here. This is a small slice of the pie, but still every bit counts.
Right. This is it, isn't it? I suppose you can't have a policy. Yeah. If you let some go, then you, to some degree, you set a precedent or certainly you set an example that people perhaps with larger books will look at and go, well, what's the deterrent? So I suppose this is all part of that strategy. And in this instance, it was the guy who sold his firm originally, who's one of the people leaving, or
no? There's some interesting details in this one. So the allegation is that one of the founders of the practice, I don't know if he was a founder, but he was one of the kind of rainmakers of this practice, retired in 2024, and the allegation is that he has been working as like a silent kind of agent for this trio of advisors and is basically helping them route client relationships to their new business so that the advisors themselves don't have to actively violate their restrictive covenant, you know, post-employment covenants in their contracts. Now, that advisor has, of course, you know, refuted all of those claims which have been brought by Hightower and has himself filed counterclaims against the Hightower affiliate's CEO. He's basically saying they've made it all up. They're trying to prevent, they're trying to avoid paying me what they owe me from my retirement when I retired. You know, when this advisor retired, he sold his stake in the affiliate practice to Hightower, and those payments are ongoing. And so he's claiming that Hightower and the affiliate firm are trying to avoid paying him.
They've
what
got
they
an
owe
agenda
him.
In this as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
brilliant. Do you know, it's classic stuff, you know? Well, interesting. And yeah, as you say, the timing obviously isn't deliberate on their part. They didn't plan for, they being Hightower, sorry, you know, didn't plan for us to break the news of their sale this week. And, you know, lawsuits run on their own time and aren't sort of, you know, done to fit with other news. But to your point, Andrew, you know, it speaks to where we are in this cycle of kind of whatever we want to call them, enterprise RIAs, roll-ups, aggregators.
Absolutely. And it's not just Hightower. Look at how litigious Edelman has become. And there are, you know, Mariner. I mean, there are numerous others. So
yeah, it's the new wirehouse versus wirehouse, isn't it? And I think we've talked about this before, the idea of whether there would ever be a broker protocol before RIAs. Yeah, exactly. It seems like probably not, because to what you both already said, you know, these PE firms, they spend that money. They believe these are their assets, basically, don't they? And particularly if they're looking to do a deal, they certainly don't want those assets to go down. Brilliant. Well, let's move on to our next big deal. So different type of firm, Summit Trail, also pursuing a deal. Ian, I'm not going to tease it much more than that. Take it away and maybe give readers or listeners who are less familiar with Summit Trail than us a bit of a, you know, I won't put you on the clock for this one, but a bit of background on that firm.
Well, this is the first time that we've actually talked about Summit Trail on the pod, as far as I can remember.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
So we'll have to go from the top. So Summit Trail Advisors, for listeners unfamiliar with the company, such as my family, they are a New York City-based wealth manager with about $22.1 billion in assets under management and advisement. They are one of the largest affiliates of RE middle and back office service platform, Dynasty Financial Partners. The company was founded in 2015 by a team of ex-Barclays advisors who were kind of Lehman survivors.
Ex-Lehman's before that, weren't
they? Yes, they're Lehman Brothers. Led by Jack Peterson, who's the managing partner at the firm. They've grown significantly through the recruitment of ultra high net worth folks, advisors from private banks such as Citizens Bank or BMO.
But that was also their background. They were the ultra high net worth sort of wealth division of Lehman's. Yes. Then Barclays, when Barclays bought that part of Lehman's,
exactly.
And then they broke out of that. And that's, exactly. So that's very much their background, is kind of high end private banky wealth type.
Yeah, like their average client net worth is about $45 million. This company works with the richest of the rich, basically. And we've reported that they are exploring a sale, that they've hired Ardea Partners.
Again. Well, yeah, we do mention them a lot, don't they? Hey, in amongst all this boom, there are people doing very well, and they seem to be one of them, don't they?
Yes, they have a lot of business. But yeah, so we've heard from sources with knowledge of the situation that they've already had talks with companies, strategic, such as other RIAs, interested in buying the company outright. And it makes sense. You know, if you're a large mass market RIA, you buy a company like Summit Trail, you have a massive ultra high net worth business instantly.
Yeah.
As I snap my fingers for this visual podcast.
No, it's, well, I think people might have heard the snap. It was away from the mic, but I think you pulled it off. We can add like a louder click in post, maybe. I don't know. I suppose I have two questions, really, which is one, you know, given Summit Trail was, let's call it, for want of a better phrase, an early RIA, you know. It was there, not quite from the beginning, but you said 2015, it's old. It's been around, it's highly successful, a lot of assets, and also the kind of clients that, you know, advisors would frankly kill, you know, two of those clients and you've got a whole business, frankly. So hugely desirable. I guess the interesting thing perhaps is why it hadn't looked for a deal before. And then the follow-on from that would be, and then why is it doing so now?
Well, I think it makes sense to strike while the iron is hot. I mean, that's a big thing. I think another factor that might have pushed them towards it, you know, there were rumblings about this before, nothing we were able to report, but they lost a massive chunk of assets when three big advisors left the company to join New Edge Wealth back in late 2025. And we saw there was an immediate effect on their assets under management. So this is using SEC filings. This isn't speculation or anything like that or sourced. Their AUM, they reported to the SEC, went from $26.2 billion to $19.9 billion. So they lost.
We don't know that's all from that.
Not all from that, but.
But it's at around the same time that team left.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about a little bit less than a quarter of your business flying the coop.
Okay, so the idea is, you know, that kind of maybe forced them to think about something a bit. And but to the best of your knowledge, have they ever explored a sale before?
You know, again, like we had, it had been something that had been floating around for a while, but we were never able to get it to a point where I felt comfortable comfortable reporting it.
Do you feel comfortable talking about it now, or have I put you in a difficult position?
I mean, I would like to probably refer to Hugh to what we actually kind of put out there, which is that they are really going for it right now.
Okay. So what you were going to get at, I'll take the bullet on this. You were getting at that you had heard rumors in the past and they might have looked at something.
Yes.
But we never to the degree that we could report it. So listener, take that with the requisite caveats. All right. And you mentioned Dynasty there. What does this mean for Dynasty? So they were one of the first firms that affiliated with Dynasty or used Dynasty. I suppose used Dynasty services would be a better way of describing it. And I would assume one of the biggest still in it today.
Yeah, they're definitely one of the biggest affiliated with Dynasty. Now, it's worth noting that, you know, SummonTrail was a business that, you know, it helped kind of legitimize Dynasty as the company grew. I mean, this is a big kind of white shoe team that Dynasty helped launch. It was huge for the platform. And I think that the continued success having a firm of that scale on the platform is something that Dynasty could point to when recruiting additional breakaways out.
Got it. And it stayed loyal to Dynasty, despite the fact that, like, I don't mean this in any rude way at all, but obviously once it got to a certain size and scale, it could have, if it had wanted to, stand up most of its operations entirely by itself.
Yeah. And, you know, there are a lot of firms that historically use Dynasty for transition assistance, would get up and running after a couple of years and then disaffiliated because Dynasty historically operated on a basis point fee. Now, Dynasty recognized that they need to have a stickier business, and they've moved towards making a lot more minority investments in their affiliated RIAs.
Got it. But they don't have an investment in SummonTrail. SummonTrail is owned by Jack Peterson, you mentioned, so, and other partners.
SummonTrail is greater than 90% employee owned. I don't know specifically whether Dynasty has taken stake, whether it's de minimis or otherwise, because SummonTrail's ADV, everything's held through a series of kind of opaque holding companies. So there's no direct indication of a Dynasty investment in the business. I don't want to speculate to that.
Okay. Could you speculate to who does own it, to the best of your knowledge?
It's the managing partners.
Yes.
Got it. Okay. Jack Peterson, the CIO, Dave Romhill, some of the founding advisors.
And in the event that this then gets acquired by a strategic, so another large wealth management firm or something, that would more than likely mean that it would no longer be part of Dynasty.
Yes, exactly.
Assuming it got subsumed into a different business.
They would be leaving Dynasty in the event of a sale because, unless they sold to another Dynasty RIA, but I consider that kind of low probability because, you know, you're moving your client's assets to that other firm's ADV and you're using their technology, their middle and back office. So the company would no longer exist.
Got it. Okay. Well, again, we'll look out for that. Do we know if talks are ongoing, do we think something potentially could be imminent there?
I think we could hear something on this sooner rather than later.
Got it. Very interesting. All right. Thank you, Ian. Now, away from deals to
gambling.
Gambling. Yeah, exactly.
Something financial advisors famously love.
I mean, at this point in America, everyone seems to love gambling. Yeah. You've gone from a country of...
Yeah, but they don't like
the prudes to absolutely, you know,
they don't like the type of gambling that I like.
What's that?
There are not enough poker players these days. Vegas are getting rid of poker rooms.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Let's go down this detail for a second. What is it? It's all just sports books. Is that everything that everyone gambles on?
Well, not even that. Sports books are also really low margin business for casinos.
Okay.
The biggest percentage of profit for casinos are slot machines. Because you don't need anybody to actively man them, and because they have a guaranteed hold percentage, you know that you're going to get a 20% or so margin on a slot machine. And think about the labor cost of having one person maintaining a bank of slot machines versus a poker room full of dealers, cashiers, chip runners, and floor personnel.
It's like sort of AI dystopia, isn't it? It's just sort of all machines and no fun. I've never been to Vegas, so there's a fun fact for you. But one day...
I've tried.
What, to go with you?
Yeah.
We'll go one day for work, I should emphasize.
There's advisor conferences in Vegas, every day and twice on Sunday.
I know, and yet somehow I've managed to avoid. Okay, and we'll go. We'll go in the next year, okay, for one or other advisor conference. Let's get back to the topic at hand. So this is a bet, Andrew, between...
Yeah. Yeah,
TV's Mark Cuban and RIA's P. Peter Malouk.
Yeah, this is a fun one. So people who've been following our reporting or following, you know, kind of RIA Twitter, if that is a thing, for five or more years, will remember in 2021, Malouk and Mark Cuban had a little bit of a rift on the social media platform. I think Mark Cuban was tweeting about Dogecoin, which at the time was soaring on like Elon Musk just total
on the kind of things
dumb
that
comments.
These coins may soar on. Yeah.
And Malouk took issue with some of the ways that Cuban was maybe representing his own kind of investment philosophy and some of his own personal investment decisions, you know, to the general public through his you know, enormous kind of platform. And so they got in a little bit of a tiff on Twitter. I don't have the tweets in front of me, but there may have been a Dumb and Dumber meme that Malouk had made up and put that out, and that ruffled Cuban's feathers. And so they ended up entering into $2 million wagers, separate bets with one another, basically after this little tiff about how, you know, one of these investment philosophies is dangerous and you shouldn't be saying this to the public, and Cuban had to put his money where his mouth is. So the story is basically...
So wait, just rewind in case I've missed it, and forgive me if I have, listener and Andrew, what were the two bets?
Yeah, so Peter Malouk, they're 10-year, on a 10-year time horizon, Peter Malouk has put $1 million up saying that he believes the S&P 500 will deliver greater total returns than... two different 50-50 portfolios. And Cuban has taken the 50-50 portfolios. So one of those is a portfolio 50% allocated to Bitcoin, 50% to Ethereum. So we've got the S&P versus essentially crypto. And the other 50-50 portfolio was a mix of Netflix and Amazon stocks. So you've got the S&P versus crypto and the S&P versus basically
two of the Mag 7.
That's right.
Although probably now the two of the Mag 7 that have, I haven't looked at Amazon enough, but certainly not the two of the Mag 7 that are getting the biggest boost from AI. Certainly Netflix isn't. Okay, so there's two separate $1 million bets.
Correct.
Okay, and how is, so with the five, the reason you're writing about it, and thus we're talking about it, is we're at the 5-year stage.
We're at the halfway mark.
And
it's a little bit of a fool's errand to measure investment performance at the halfway mark of a time horizon. Like,
I think it depends what the gap is, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's fair too.
But what's the what's the running look like?
Basically, Peter's winning.
Yeah,
both bets by quite a large margin.
Okay, so Bitcoin and Ethereum portfolio has delivered -2.2.
If you can believe it, that's actually correct. I've done the calculations. Bitcoin has skyrocketed, but it's obviously volatile and it's lost a lot of ground.
It's way off the highs, right?
It's way off the highs since October.
Time frame here will be important too. If you did 10 years back from now, I'm sure it's probably, you know,
a million percent. Yeah.
You're capturing a lot of 22 here, aren't you, as well, which is going to take a big impact on these things.
That's right. But Ethereum has lost over the 5 years. It has really cratered from 2,700 roughly per unit to under 2,000. So that's really been dragging everything down. And I mean, even like the last 5 days, Bitcoin was down 8%. So this kind of volatility should factor into the way that you view the comparison a little bit. And it's obviously been just a storming 5 years for the S&P, which is up, I think, more than 80%, not including dividend reinvestments. And obviously the S&P does pay out a dividend. So it's closer to 90% if you factor that in.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Fair enough.
And the tech portfolio is doing better than the crypto, but not quite as well as the S&P. I think those two stocks, you know, are blended to have returned something like 56.7%, which is pretty good. I mean, not bad.
Yeah, and has obviously that returns included in the S&P.
In the S&P, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
But the S&P has other things like Nvidia, et cetera, that have probably helped
really
help move things along. Okay, have they spoken about this at all? Are they in touch on X? Or
I don't know. I couldn't get much out of Peter. He was overseas when I reached out to him, so I didn't talk too much to him. But you know, his view was basically, yeah, there's a long way to go, and invoking Lenny Kravitz, there it ain't over till it's over. So
fair enough. And I suppose we should say, just for context, there's kind of echoes here of the Warren Buffett, Ted, yes. Is it Ted Seides? Ted Seides? I don't know how you say the name out loud. I've only ever read it, which was effectively also a bet on Buffett's part that the S&P would outperform versus Ted's part of the bet, which was, I think it was a sort of basket of hedge funds or fund of funds.
And I think Buffett won that.
Buffett won that pretty comfortably. Pretty handily, yeah. Again, timing was a lot of it, wasn't it? I can't remember what that period ran from until, but during that time, the S&P absolutely crushed it, as it is doing again this year and is often wont to do. Excellent.
Well, what is interesting quickly, I mean, you know, just going back and looking at kind of the way that things were back when they made that bet, Creative Planning, Peter Malouk's RIA, was like $75 billion. It is 10 times that today, which is pretty amazing. You know, as an observation, like, to see how far that company has come over the last five is pretty insane as well.
That's very, yeah, that's interesting. And I guess from his point of view, that means that he can probably sleep a little bit easier about this bet one way or another.
That's right.
Than he could have done before. And the proceeds go to charity anyway, but yeah, Someone still has to pay for it.
Correct.
So,
yeah. I mean, Cuban's a billionaire. Like two mil isn't gonna hurt too bad. It's the principle for him, you know?
No, absolutely.
Both of these guys.
I think that might have gone. Fantastic. Well, look, Andrew, thank you. Before we go, anything else that we should be across, guys?
By the time this pod comes out, we'll have had our 10th anniversary party.
We will have done. I trailed that out at the beginning, and I think, yeah, next week we're going to gather the same three of us again to have a little look back at the last 10 years for Citywire, specifically Citywire RAA, some of the stories that we've covered, but it won't be entirely rather navel-gazing. I think we'll also kind of look back at what's changed in that time, how the industry's developed, a little bit about, you know, to Andrew's point, what markets have done, etc. So it should be really good. Maybe we could finish with a plug. So we did actually for this 10-year anniversary, which is not the focus of this episode at all, we have made a one-off print special, which we'll be sending out to people. If you'd like a copy and you're not sure whether you'll be on the list or not, get in touch with us. Email us at news@citywireusa.com and we will send one to you in the post. It's really good. I can't remember what it's about, 80 pages. Thick, nice thick paper stock, which is enjoyable.
There's a long proof.
A lot of proofreading. But that looks back a lot. And I think that was a really fun exercise in kind of figuring out what's changed in that time, what we've learned, how we've evolved, how the industry's evolved. Andrew.
It's nice when we get to do stuff in print. Like, I don't know, we did the print magazine up until a couple of years ago. I miss it. It was fun. We got to do different kinds of pieces and, you know, there's nothing precluding us from doing that sort of stuff for the website. But yes, just nice. It's just nice to
it is a print product. I like is them. Nice. Maybe it's going to come back.
Work,
maybe in this age of AI, when everything's just sort of slop and agents and everything, maybe, you know, those who want to be informed will return to the most trusted medium of all, paper. So look out, Rainforest. We're going to get you. Well, I think we've covered a lot there. So thank you very much, Ian. Thank you, Andrew. Wonderful to have you here. Thank you as ever, listener. And we will be back again very soon for another episode of This Week in Wealth.